From the editors at Paranormal Underground and Ghost Knight Publishing, welcome to Paranormal Underground Presents, where you can explore the unexplained with our panel and special guests.
Welcome. We have a good show planned tonight. We're going to be talking to the members of Haunted South Paranormal Research and also the radio show Haunted South Paranormal Radio, Lisa and Ray Abney, and also Stephen Rabel. Before we get to them, I wanted to introduce our panel. It's the usual suspects. We have our publisher, Chad. Hey, Chad.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. And we have our science editor, J.D. Harrison. Hi. And we have our editor-in-chief, Cheryl Knight. Hi, Cheryl.
Hey, Karen. How are you today?
I'm pretty good. We're going to be talking to them about the Henryton Project, and they're doing a documentary. Now, do we have the name of the documentary that they're doing, Cheryl?
I just think it's called the Henryton Project.
Oh, wait, no, I just found it. I'm sorry. It's Secret Sacrifices, the Henryton Project. Henryton is a sanitarium. It was a TB hospital in Maryland. And apparently there's some really interesting findings coming out of there. Now, they're not going to be able to discuss their findings with us, as I understand, but they're going to discuss the project. And then later, after the documentary is released, they'll come back and tell us their findings. Is that right?
Right. And what they're going to do today is discuss kind of why they did this research, who was involved, and the type of investigation they carried out. And then once their documentary is released, they'll be able to do a follow-up podcast on the findings. And I hear that there's some pretty good findings. So can't wait for that.
Great. Let's go ahead and get started then. As I said before, our guests this evening are from Haunted South Paranormal Research and Haunted South Paranormal Radio. First with us is Stephen Rabel. Hey, Stephen.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing great. It's good to talk to you again.
It is. Thank you for having us on tonight.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it. Next, we have Lisa Abney. Hi, Lisa.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well, thank you. And then also we have Ray Abney, who we talked with on Stephen's program as well. Hi, Ray.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great. We kind of explained to you how it's going to go. Everybody's going to ask you questions for about 10 minutes. When we're done talking to you, you guys can hang up and we get to talk about you behind your back.
Okay, that's
all
fine.
Right. Okay, so the first person asking questions will be Cheryl. So go ahead, Cheryl.
Thanks, Karen. Thank you so much, Lisa, Ray, and Stephen, for being here. I'm really looking forward to our discussion. And I was hoping that you could start off by telling us a little bit about your group as well as your radio show.
Yeah, absolutely. Lisa, you want to go?
Sure. Well, we are Haunted South Paranormal Research. We've been around for a couple of years now.
Just a couple,
yeah. Doing this now since 2001, officially. Really, just that's the most I can say about the group. We do everything you can think of, historical locations, residential homes, abandoned buildings, hospitals, you name it at this point. We've pretty much done
okay.
It.
Talk a little bit about the radio show.
Yeah, we have a radio show, and I started the radio show last May, and it was Michigan Paranormal Underground Radio. But actually, with working with Ray and Lisa of Haunted South Paranormal Research, I moved to Tampa since then. I was very impressed with the way that they go about things, and everybody was on the same page with, you know, just how we like to do things and the passion mm-hmm. that we have for paranormal research. So I ended up moving out here, and the radio show is now called Haunted South Paranormal Radio, an extension of the group to kind of, you know, have different guests on and kind of update people on what we're doing and just on our lives and what's going on. The radio show it's a lot of fun. It's a highly effective mm-hmm. way to, it's another avenue for people to really get to know who we are and what we're doing and be able to reach an audience all around the world through the internet. But it's a lot of fun. Yeah. Ray's co-host with it, and I steal Lisa from time to time, mm-hmm. and we just have a lot of fun.
How can people tune into the radio show if they're interested?
Well, you can Google Haunted South Paranormal Radio. I mean, it's on Blog Talk Radio. You can search Blog Talk Radio and then search Stephen Rabel or Haunted South Paranormal Radio, and then it'll take you right to the homepage. But the easiest really way to do it is just go to Google and Haunted South Paranormal Radio, and then it'll be right on there.
Okay, cool. Let's talk about one of your latest projects. You're working in coordination with a lot of other groups, I understand, on the Henryton Project. Can you talk about how that first came about and who is involved in the project?
Actually, if we go back to how we got involved with it, we were a guest on Stephen's show before he moved down to Florida. And Jenny Stewart from PRRS, the Paranormal Research and Resource Society, called in, and we were discussing some of our cases, and she said, you know, I really think you guys should come and work on this. You know, we have a lot in common. I want you to be a part of this project. And from there, she and I started talking a lot on the phone and starting to do research and everything. We really got into it, and we decided that we were going to be a part of it. And from there, it had already had other teams involved with it. Maine Ghost Hunters was involved, and Maryland Ghost Hunters as well. And then we came in, and then Michael McDonald's team, Kindred Moon, they came in as well. And by the end, we came one big, happy paranormal family working in the of hell.
Wow. How many groups total are involved? And then aside from that, how many individual investigators are involved?
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, geez. There's, well, PRRS, Haunted South.
Michigan Paranormal Project.
Before Stephen joined us. So that's
Maryland Ghost Hunters.
Maine Ghost Hunters.
So a total of six teams, including Michael McDonald.
Okay.
And then as far as investigators, I think there's, if I had to look at the paperwork, I'd say there's 17 different investigators, if not more. We have many people come and go at different times during different portions of the investigation that.
Yeah, we've actually.
17 and 20.
We've actually made a couple trips to Maryland to do this and spent, you know, like 5 to 7 days up there each time we went up.
Okay.
And each time we went in, we had some different people with us. So, you know, Mike McDonald's team came in for the second portion.
The third portion, actually.
Yeah, the second that we were truly involved with. And so, it's quite a diverse team. It's quite a large team. And it's given all of us a chance to do what we really love doing, which is working with other teams and seeing how other teams work, how they compile their findings, different techniques that one team may use.
Even different equipment.
And different equipment as well, yeah. We got a chance to use some stuff that we've wanted to use but never had the chance to, and vice versa. You know, we took some stuff and put it on the table, so to speak, for everybody else to be able to use. So it worked out well, and it's still in the process, but the finished product's going to be amazing.
Can you tell us, what is Henryton?
Henryton Hospital is a former segregated tuberculosis hospital. It was opened in 1923 by the state of Maryland for strictly African-American patients suffering from various stages of tuberculosis. It was closed temporarily in 1961 and converted to a hospital for the severely mentally handicapped, and then permanently closed in December of 1984.
Okay.
It is massive. There were originally 18 buildings, and unfortunately now there are 11 buildings standing. Square footage I have written down for the documentary, but I think it's somewhere in the range of about 350,000 square feet. So it's a monster.
It sounds like a huge undertaking, even for six groups.
Yeah, it was.
I don't think everyone even got the chance to cover every square inch just on walking tours and trying to figure out what's safe and what isn't. I don't think we covered every single room there.
Was it hard to get permission to get in there? Because if I understand it correctly, they don't just let anybody go in there and investigate.
Yeah, it was very difficult, in fact. Very trying. That was probably one of the most difficult things, was attempting to get it and then going through red tape and trying to do everything you can. That was the most difficult portion. And then, you know, once you're in there, you realize exactly why they don't want people to go in there. The conditions of the buildings are pretty bad. It's pretty bad, so.
There's been a lot of vandalism over the years. Kids go out there during the day and just the place, you know. People
pull
out of it just to recycle the aluminum. And there's truly no fence around the place. It's very easy to get into, so people go in there all the time and just destroy it.
Okay.
It's really a shame, because the place at one time was, you know, such a beautiful group of buildings, and now there's portions that you wouldn't want to go into for safety reasons.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the primary goals of the group going into the investigation, if you feel that you fulfilled those goals in the end?
I will try without giving away too much. Idea was, initially, Jenny Stewart with PRRS, her team, they went in there, found out about the location, and then realized how active it was. And she wanted to bring in other teams. You know, she actually really did want to bring in other teams to get other people's opinions, other people's input, and evidence as well to say, okay, so what is everyone getting from this? When you sit back and you look at it, you realize you cannot have just one team go in there. It would take 2 years to properly do an investigation there if you had a team of maybe six people. It kind of evolved over time. Originally, it was just the investigation, and then it became, well, you know, this place is so unique and so incredible that, you know, history is wiped off the map. It's not even there anymore. Just finding that was next to impossible. Just trying to explain it to people sometimes, they're like, well, there isn't anything. I'm like, no, there's nothing. There's nothing left. But she wanted to bring everyone in, and then it evolved into, when we started working in the project too, well, let's make a documentary, because it takes so many people to do this. It's taken a lot of work just for her and I to do the research on it. I mean, we spent 4 months every single day trying to figure out what happened to these people or what became of them afterwards.
With it being a segregated hospital as well, there was so much history that people truly don't know about. I mean, we've even had calls into the NAACP, and they weren't able to help us. We've gone through so many different channels just trying to get information, and all of the information that we have been able to gain has all really not been good. A lot of medical experimentation, a lot of really nasty things were done to these people, as they were also in other TB hospitals. You know, when you think of Beverly Hills, you hear about the, experiments that went on in the name of medicine to try and find a cure for TB. That
they were really just spitballing the whole time. Yeah, I don't think they had a clue.
Wow.
They were, they tried a lot of different forms of things that ended up being worse for the patients than it did any good, you know?
Okay.
And we've found through our studies and what we were able to find on Henryton that was even more accelerated, unfortunately, because a lot of these people were viewed as expendable. Just because of the poverty level and things like that, you know, there were people that were sent there to die. That families were poor and they weren't even able to come and claim the body. A lot of really gruesome things happened there, and the more we got into this in depth and the more we studied it, the more we were able to pull out through our investigations, it was evident that this had been happening.
Now, I saw something on your MySpace status at one point, I believe, that said something to the effect that you are facing some spiritual warfare. Is that something you could talk about today?
As the co-executive producer, I will say that at one point during the final leg of the investigation, and I can't give away details, but I will say that it became far more active and far more difficult than we had ever experienced before there. And I think a lot of us had never experienced prior in the level that it was. That was really a desperate moment that we really did need as many good vibes come in our way as we could.
Well, we can say this. We had an idea, a plan as to how this documentary were originally going to end. What our plan was after we compiled as much research as we possibly could. Final day that we were going to be up there, we were going to do a memorial, basically. For the patients and the people that, you know, the thousands and thousands of people that lost their lives in Henryton. Inevitably, the motion picture cannot end that way because of what we ended up experiencing. You've got six different teams between, 15 and 17 to 20 members each time we went up that will never set foot on that property again because of what happened. We ended up cutting our shooting schedule by 3 days because
for safety concerns.
Yeah. I mean, it was something that we never expected it to be.
Mm-hmm.
It was something that none of us thought we would experience in there. There's still people in the groups that aren't quite right to this day because of it. We cannot do what we originally set out to do because none of us will set foot back in there.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about the documentary that you're currently putting together on the Henryton Project and when we can expect to see it?
Well, we actually just recently got contacted by someone who is a former patient. So we have some pickup shots, fortunately, that we have to do right now. But what we are documenting in it is the history that we have been able to get ourselves as far as giving some of these people a name that they never had.
Mm-hmm.
The activity that is now there, because the activity, I can tell you, is I still have a strong pull there because of how incredible it is, but at the same time, it's very difficult to want to step foot there.
Mm-hmm.
So we are trying to kind of give a voice to people that didn't have one when they were alive and really memorialize what that place was and the people that were there and what they went through and what, in turn, we all went through in the process of trying to find out this forgotten piece of America. I mean, that's really what it is. And it has changed the way I look at everything as far as when it comes to researching anything we do. But yeah, we are hoping that it'll be out by the end of the year.
Okay.
We're still working right now. But yeah, we've actually had things come up where now we're able to put these different parts into the documentary that we didn't ever dream we would get a hold of, like people who were there as patients. We never thought for a second that we'd ever hear that, and then we get this phone call out of the blue. So
for quite some time, we tried to find people who had either worked there or people who were admitted there that could possibly still be alive. And we came up empty-handed time and time again. And then out of the blue, Lisa and myself and our team came back to Florida, and we got into post-production and started, uploading all
editing,
the footage and editing and trying to figure out, you know, exactly what we could and could not use.
Not to mention 200 hours of audio to review.
Yeah. And the review process itself was amazing. Haunted South took on the actual production of this film.
Okay.
We had not only our evidence, but we had all of the evidence that every team that was with us on numerous trips were able to obtain.
Mm-hmm.
So we literally have
hundreds of hours of audio and video.
Hundreds of hours that we have to go through. So the editing process is going to take some time.
Right.
Making a two-hour documentary out of hundreds of hours of things, and we don't want to miss anything. We don't want to leave anything that we feel could be remotely important out.
It's a long stretch. But, yeah, I mean, we still are working with all the teams. Obviously, every team that gave their footage to us, they're still going through their stuff as well.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing their review and sending us numbers and times and timestamps and going, you have to look right here. We're still doing all of that, but at the same time, we're still piecing everything together.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like a very time-consuming process to put the documentary together. I know I'm looking forward to it. How can people follow the progress of the Henryton Project if they are interested in doing so online?
Well, I think we're actually getting ready to set up a website. Jenny Stewart is doing that with PRRS. She's setting up a website, which I believe is thehenrytonproject.com or Henryton Project. I know they're building the site right now. Or any of our individual MySpace pages.
Okay.
Unfortunately, we have to say MySpace is a great resource for you to get in touch with us.
It's difficult for us to say that we can keep people updated. We can keep them updated with
releases.
When the release date is going to be most likely and how the editing is going. But we're all under a strict, hush order, so to speak.
Yeah, we all sign non-disclosure agreements. So.
Okay.
We feel that we can't let any of our true findings or anything of that nature get out into the public as of yet. Just trying to do that alone is a great undertaking because you've got numerous people from numerous teams all over the country And yeah, we all want to put our photographs up. We all want to let everybody know what we experienced. And it's painstaking to try and keep that from happening. We don't want to really blow it until people get a chance to see the finished product. So yes, we can say that we can set up a website and let everybody know, well, this is where we stand. We're going to do the release at this time. We're going to put it in this film festival and that film festival or whatever the case might be. But anything other than that, we really can't divulge right now.
Also, with the project wrapping up, we're turning whatever we earn from this around so we can set up the Henryton Foundation. So that way we can get equipment into teams' hands and, you know, hopefully do something with local charities and getting tuberculosis, vaccinations for people. We're trying to figure out ways to pay it forward because there's no real reason why we should be banking off of the backs of all these people. When you get this deep involved with a project like this, you just can't imagine lining your pockets with that kind of money, you know? So it's like,
right.
Okay, the main goal when we're done with it is to be able to say, okay, your team needs equipment. We're going to help get you equipment that you need, okay?
Mm-hmm.
This is what we're doing, so.
And we've already given away a Zoom H2 digital recorder. We gave that away last week.
Yeah, last Tuesday.
So,
oh, wow.
As some money comes in from either financial backers or...
Which I seriously doubt are going to be waiting in the wings. But.
You know, but anytime we do see some money from this project, we're not going to, as Lisa said, we're not going to line our pockets with the money. And we don't know if we're going to make anything off of this or not.
No.
You know,
no.
We're
going to be in the red for this one.
we want to get it distributed and put it on DVD. And get it distributed so people can see it. And if a network would pick it up and air it, that would be wonderful. But any financial gain that we see off of this, we would like to get it back into the paranormal community to help other people out, you know.
Oh, that's great. That's great. That, I think, wraps up my questions. So I'll thank you, and I will go ahead and pass it on to Chad Wilson.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, good. Chad.
Hey, I was just wanting to ask you, could you talk about your methodology used in your investigation?
We have numerous methodologies. It actually depends on the location that we go into.
Okay.
Of course, if we're doing a residential or something of that nature, Lisa, who works as our case manager, will do the pre-interview and, you know, get as much information as we can as to what has happened, what they're experiencing, how long it's been going on, you know, to which members of the family. We also have a woman who works with us, Alana Baker, who's a member of our team. She is our archivist, our historian. She does all the research work as far as let's try and get as much information on property history as we can, see if there's any anomalies there, you know, things that have happened on the property, people who have died, you know, your typical run-of-the-mill things. That
And in the same vein as that, too, to find out if people say, you know, when you walk in and, oh, my house is built on an old cemetery. Well, actually, no, it wasn't.
Yeah.
I think we go pretty scientific when it comes to methodology. It's scientific first because, I mean... If somebody comes to me and they said, oh, my, 2 nights ago, my whole house was shaking, the first thing I look at is USGS.gov. Did you experience an earthquake? Even in Florida, yes, we do occasionally have earthquakes. I mean, I don't want to say we go into every location looking to find the ghost for you. We exhaust every, avenue that we can before we say, okay, here's what's going on.
Right. If it is a residence, if it is a place that, you know, still has power, if it's not an abandoned building, of course, we'll go in, do an initial
sweep
of the house, you know, do readings, see if there's unshielded wiring, try and get something that would be man-made and not paranormal out of the picture, you know.
Okay.
We're really into the debunking end of it.
We've been on plenty of investigations where we got nothing.
We've been on plenty of investigations where we've found, you know, an antique alarm clock that was setting off really, really high levels of EMF. And, you know, we're able to help a woman out by showing her that the things in her home weren't paranormal. This is what's causing what you're experiencing. And, you know, helped her out that way, gave her peace of mind, and actually had some things fixed that could have been potentially hazardous in the home.
Yeah. What is your feeling on EMF? Do you think it's basically a cause of symptoms that are maybe comparable to what people experience in a paranormal situation? Or do you think it's maybe something that maybe a spirit or something can actually cause?
Both. I've seen unbelievable things happen with EMF levels in an area where there should be no EMF whatsoever.
Okay.
Like in a building with no power.
Yeah, no power.
I've actually had it happen at Villisca, so.
Miles and miles and miles, you have no power. You have no investigators with cell phones on them. You take every precaution to make sure you're not getting any type of false readings off of other equipment, you know, two-way radios or cell phones or other pieces of equipment, you know. And when you see something like that happen, you have to believe that it's happening for a reason. And if it happens in conjunction with other things that you can place together, one of the main things we do is when we go through our evidence, first of all, we film everything. We have numerous cameramen that go with us on every investigation we do. The reason we do that is not to do the YouTube videos or not to, you know, film our own little version of a television show, but catch every piece of evidence we possibly can on video. When we get it into Final Cut Pro and we start editing everything, you can then line up your audio from your voice recorders. You can line up your video. We can line everything up. What we have found in the past is we tend to get EVPs along with K2 fluctuation or EMF fluctuation. Sometimes we have things happen with cameras. Focusing issues tend to go along in hand when we know we're getting something, you know. I guess to answer your question, honestly, it depends on the location we're in. We have different theories and different ways set up to deal with different types of locations.
Well, I just want to ask you, like with EMF, have you ever noticed, like, maybe you might get a temperature drop in conjunction with? Okay, because I've had that happen to me before, so.
Especially here in Florida, with it being as warm as it is, if you start getting a temperature drop, you can really feel it. And,
yes.
You know, Steve and I have had that conversation. He said, you know, I never used a thermometer in paranormal research until I moved to Florida. In Michigan, it's cold. You can't do
that. Yeah, you can't tell, yeah.
But, you know, around here you get into the southern states, and we just experienced that a couple weeks ago when we went into the Ringling Estate. We had temperature drop as well as K2 fluctuation and got EVPs at the same time. And we had camera malfunctioning issues, batteries dropping out, you know, brand new batteries just taking a header within moments. And if you can line all that up together, it starts making sense.
You had talked about special equipment you guys had used on the Henderson project. Can you discuss any of that?
Yeah, I think so.
We just can't talk about evidence.
Just can't talk about evidence. Okay.
Yeah, we used everything we could possibly get our hands on. Infrared. We used a ghost box numerous times.
Really?
Frank's box.
Okay.
We used an ovilus.
How do you guys feel about the ovilus? I've heard mixed reviews on it.
I was kind of on the fence with both the ghost box and the ovilus.
Okay.
And we ended up kind of using them in conjunction with each other.
Okay.
And were able to get the same results from both simultaneously, which we found really, really interesting. We used the one to back the other up, so to speak.
Okay.
And the one thing about the ghost box, you have to remember that, you know, FCC regulations kind of prevent you from saying certain things or doing certain things on the radio. One of the theories that we go by is if you can get a ghost box to use profanity, so to speak, then you really have to take into consideration that it could be something other than it just going over a station.
Random art,
or audio matrixing and putting words together to form a statement. Yeah, we've had a lot of success with the Frank's Box and with the Ovilus. Yeah, Stephen was actually on the fence about using K2 meters. He had never seen a K2 truly work until we got into Henryton.
Yeah.
And then, actually, he's seen him work on the last two investigations we've been on down here. So we use everything we can possibly get our hands on. We used K2s, K3s, mm-hmm. IR photography. We used the H2. We've been using a Zoom H2 digital recorder as our primary digital voice recorder. We stumbled onto it some months back, and they're absolutely amazing. I highly suggest, if you have, you know, 100 and some odd bucks, go out and pick one up, because they just put everything else away.
Also, I wanted to ask, how was the project successfully coordinated, you know, with so many groups involved?
A lot of planning.
A lot of hair pulling.
But I know different groups have different methodologies, you know, different ways they investigate. You guys just pretty much, each group kind of kept to themselves and investigated different areas, or?
We broke the groups up. We broke,
We intermingled everybody and put team leaders in charge, and then it was left up to the groups individually that were out there to figure out the best way and what they wanted to do. And honestly, and this is no lie, if it wasn't for the fact that everyone actually got along really well mm-hmm. and was respectful of each other's different way of doing things, I mean, we all work pretty similar, but there were still some differences. Like, we had never worked with the Ovilus before, but we wanted to see it. I'm skeptical of it, but I saw some interesting things that I couldn't explain. But really, we just kind of cut everybody loose and said, okay, here's where you're going to be today. And they went, and they did their job. And, you know, I couldn't have asked for a better way for it to have worked out, because we really did. We just gave everybody the freedom to work the way they felt most comfortable, and, you know, thinking that would be the most successful way to put everyone out there, and they did it.
And before we went up, we actually sat down and wrote up a timeline, basically.
Okay.
We know we're going to have this many hours of daylight. We know we're going to have this many hours to go in at night. We know we're going to have this many people, this many groups. And there's so many buildings to cover in this place.
Yeah.
We actually set it up as a film shoot rather than just an investigation.
Okay.
So we knew at 8 o'clock in the morning we're getting up. At 9 o'clock in the morning we're going to be on the road to get there. It'll take us this long to get there. As soon as we get there, this is what we're going to do. And each day we would break the teams up differently. You know, one day it would be half of Kindred Moon Paranormal with, you know, a couple members of Haunted South with a couple members of Maine Ghost Hunters, and you guys are going to go here with a cameraman. And then, you know, the rest of your team and the rest of our team and some members of PRRS are going to take another cameraman, and they're going to go into this building. And we had each location scouted out where we knew that we had found activity before.
Okay.
Intensify that investigation. We needed to get in there for longer periods of time. We also knew that Team A was going to go into this building and just work on EVPs. Team B was going to go into this building and do an Ovilus session.
Okay.
So we had all of our bases covered at all times.
And then a couple times we absolutely threw that out the window and just flew by and see our... No, I'm serious.
What?
We did. There was a few times where when you get in the heat of everything and you do more things, you can't be that stringent, but it worked out. It really did work out. I couldn't have asked for better people to really come together with.
I cannot wait to see the documentary. It sounds like it's going to be very interesting. That's all for my questions. I'm going to turn you over to JD, so thank you.
Thanks, Jen.
Thank you.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Good, how's it going?
It's going pretty good. Thanks for being with us tonight. Very interesting what you're doing there. I have a couple questions here. Regarding some of the answers you gave earlier to Cheryl, her question, and also in your description of the project that you have on your website, or one of them, about the possibility of that you allude to that African Americans were used in experiments and civil rights violations. Can you elaborate on that any?
The most that I can elaborate at that is factual information that we've been able to gain through numbers using the CDC, Johns Hopkins Medical Library, and as many medical reference tests as we've been able to find that, yes, African Americans, more often than not, back way back when, between, you know, the outbreak of tuberculosis up until, I'd say, the late 40s, generally did undergo far more studies than the white population.
You've said that you have that evidence, that you have empirical evidence in that backs that up, right?
Yes.
Have you made any attempt at all to contact any civil rights agencies or organizations over this?
Yes, I have, and I've been hung up on more than once.
I'm very aware of civil rights law in the United States. I know that if evidence is out there to this fact, it will be investigated by the federal government. That's been mandated by Congress. They have to do that. I do know some people that will do that. I find that believable for the fact, the history of it. During the 20s, I know that in a lot of tuberculosis hospitals, experiments were done on a lot of patients. That was because of the medical field did not understand the process of the disease. And a lot of different cures were tried on people, and it was pretty horrific in a lot of cases. But if you have actual proof that they were, and I don't want to say singled out, but experimented on more, and especially if you look at some of the different cure attempts that they used in other hospitals, and they went beyond that and did, you know, worse things just because, then, yeah, that's a civil rights case.
And you know what? That became one of the most heartbreaking issues of dealing with this project altogether. I mean, yeah, I can say that, yes, going out there and doing these investigations where we're at, it's very trying, it's very difficult, it's very physical. But when you have to sit back and you're in your comfortable home and you start really putting together the pieces through as much documentation as you can get your hands on, which, by the way, is one of the most difficult things you can get your hands on, it becomes heartbreaking when you really start thinking about not only the implications of the questions you're asking to the possibility of spiritual activity,
right,
but then you have to really start looking at the lives of these people and what they went through. It's heartbreaking. And when you do call different civil rights agencies and you ask for help and you say, here's what I'm doing, and you get hung up on, I have been hung up on.
Okay.
That to me was, I'm telling you this is going on. I have all this stuff and you don't even want to talk to me.
Have you tried contacting the federal government, agencies of the federal government?
Honestly, I haven't gotten that far yet. And at a point, yeah, I threw my hands up because when I start looking at every available avenue I can get to, nobody seems to care. I mean, Jenny Stewart and I have kind of randomly talked about maybe we should actually contact the White House or something, you know, like.
No, it wouldn't be the White House, but there's a branch of the federal government that deals specifically with these types of civil rights violations. Are almost like cold case files, and they actively investigate these types of things. That's what they do. That's all they do. And,
well, I think you and I should talk off the air. There are some things that we've just kind of recently come into having, information that we just gained.
Okay.
People that were actually patients and things there, and also employees. Okay. We're trying to round up the rest of that information and get everybody's testimonies and what's going on, but there's a real problem. I mean, if we take away the paranormal problem for a second that's out there and we just look at the problem in the way we treat it, another piece of our humanity, there's a serious issue. Environmental issue out there as well. And that's, I mean, this started out as a documentary about an amazing paranormal thing going on, and it became so much more. It grew like a monster, and it's something that we're still like, just trying to wrap our heads around. I mean, I would have never guessed 5 months ago when you told me this is what you were going to be doing. I would have told you you were a liar. I hate to say that.
Sometimes things like that happen, especially when you can uncover research in it. See, it doesn't surprise me, like we talked about with the history and the time. And you know, even during that time in this country, we were practicing a scientific viewpoint on racism, actually, and I hate to use that term, but it was called eugenics, and I don't know if you're familiar with that, but they were actually going as far as like determining a person's intelligence by the diameter of their skulls. You know, this all fell into line with a lot of things when I was doing my research before I came here tonight to ask you these questions. And that's why these things popped up. It all fits the history. My next question for you is, and you don't have to name any names, but have you come across in your research with this, like medical directors, people who were governing these experiments or directing them, anything like that?
I have in my possession the name of every director, superintendent, head nurse, including a group of five individuals that were picked by the state of Maryland to oversee African-American hospitals.
Right. And now, was this hospital state-funded?
Yes, it was.
Okay. Well, we'll talk later, okay, on this matter, because I could be on this for a while, and I don't want to do that. Next question. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Not to cut you off, but also, as Lisa stated, there's also an environmental issue going on out there. We wore gloves and masks the whole time we were in there. Some investigators actually wore full-on respirators. Quite a few just wore, like, as high-end dust masks as we could find.
Okay.
The asbestos that's in all of those buildings is unbelievable. And as I stated earlier, there's no fence around this place. There's no barbed wire around it. Kids go in there constantly and kick the walls in, rip the ceilings out. There's areas of the building that have been lit on fire by kids just going in and vandalizing. And there is nothing anywhere that states that there's a problem with asbestos. We have video when we were doing one of the ovilus sessions, and I didn't even notice it. My wife did. We were in a basement doing an ovilus session, and she goes, "Oh, my God, look at all the raw asbestos just laying there inches away from where you guys put the ovilus down." And we were down there for a couple hours.
Have you notified the state about this?
Yes, we have.
The state of Maryland, and they've done nothing?
Not as far as we've seen, nothing. And we actually have video even of, from when we weren't in the process of filming or investigating, we were just kind of running video, as we'd done many times over when there were kids vandalizing, and we came across of five children, and I do mean children, between the ages of most likely 10 and 12, with an adult, like, damaging the buildings and walking out of these spaces where we wouldn't go and knock stuff around because it's like, are you kidding me?
Wow.
You know, and when we would see that in certain buildings, we wouldn't even go in those buildings for a couple days just to make sure whatever was in there could possibly have calmed down.
Does the state still manage the property?
Currently, it is under the management of the Department of Natural Resources in Maryland.
Okay.
Which is... Maryland Environmental Services actually has some sort of strange water, it's like a giant water barrel next to the side of the property, and it's an environmental, it's got the sign posted Environmental Services in Maryland, and it's fenced off, you can't get in, but we were cracking up going, Environmental Services, like right next to asbestos headquarters, this is hilarious, you know?
Yeah.
There's a public drinking supply there too, so I mean... Some of the buildings that are out there are historically just beautiful. They are. But the problem is that they have been so badly vandalized and broken, and now people are going in and actually taking windows and doors and cast iron sinks and whatever you can think of that they can go and hawk for money.
Yeah, I read that. They're aluminum and things. So.
Yeah, aluminum, copper. I mean, we've gone 1 week and then gone 3 days later, and there's an entire telephone pole that's knocked down because they stripped it of copper.
Wow.
All the windows out of one side of the building were taken out from the time we went up in January to the time we went up, a month?
No, 3 months later.
3 months later?
So, yeah, I mean, the fact that nobody's watching, no one's attention to that until, like, I'd say, like, I don't know, 4 or 5 years from now, a bunch of 20-year-old kids come up with mesothelioma.
That's incredible. That's just incredible. No, okay. All right. For my time here, because I'm running short, I have one more question for you. Chad had asked you about methodologies. And you had mentioned that they had varied from location to location. And from a scientific viewpoint, I commend you on that, because methodologies will vary from location. You always establish a methodology based on the location you investigate. And that's not just paranormal. That's any scientific endeavor. But one of the questions I have with equipment, and I'm not sure if you're familiar or not, but I posted this a lot on the website and forum and different types of things. I am a big proponent of, I don't want to say I'm against equipment, but equipment is important. But I am not one to who a lot of groups I notice will take equipment into an investigation and then, because they get a spike on the EMF or because they get some type of reaction, they claim that's paranormal activity. My question to them is, paranormal to date has not been quantified. And
no.
We know something's there, but we don't know what it is. So if we don't know what it is, how can we measure it? And we can use EMFs. We can use K2 meters. We can use all manner of instruments, but those readings do not tell us anything unless we properly use it, what we get. And you had mentioned correlations. And I was wondering if you record these correlations and keep track of them to possibly go back later and examine those correlations to try to determine cause.
Oh, God, yeah.
Okay.
I can tell you that just one case that we did here in Tampa that was residential, we found every reason we could for them to have certain EMF levels in certain areas of the home. We went back time again to measure them again and again, so we had our control.
Okay.
And when we looked at all of the data from that case where there was strange things that were happening, where there shouldn't have been EMF fields, where there shouldn't have been things going on or making a K2 react or making the Lutron, whatever it's called, react.
Mm-hmm.
Those types of anomalies that we got, when we could not put any sort of, okay, that was caused because there's a breaker on this side of the wall, okay, there's subwoofer caused this. When we had those types of things, we have no other place to put them but in anomalies.
They okay. are.
Now, does it mean that it's like, oh, that's definitely the spirit right there?
Mm-hmm.
Again, just as you said, we can't say that for certain because we don't know for certain. But at the same time, when you have that kind of activity that's anomalous and it does move around or it does respond to you asking for certain things to happen, like, can you make the K2 go as high as you could possibly get it and hold it?
Mm-hmm.
I have to look at that as some sort of anomalous activity. Now, what's really causing it? Again, I can't see it. I can't tell. Sometimes mm-hmm. it was in correlation with an EVP.
Okay. Now, see, that's the type of things that need to be looked for. Correlations.
Absolutely.
Where you have two simultaneous results from two different instruments, like an EVP recorded with, say, a spike in an EMF. Then you record that and you go on. Can you say that that's paranormal activity? Well, not really. Not yet. There's a lot more work that needs to be done with that. But what you do is you collect those things. You keep them recorded. And then once you have enough to do a comparative analysis where you can run a statistical program on it to see if it relates back to that. Because you, as of yet, you don't know what caused what. Did the EVP cause a spike in the EMF or vice versa? So you're not really sure, but you can see them, and that's a great, great thing. So,
yeah, and like Lisa was saying, we don't go into a place just once. We go in time and time and time again. We have cases from 2 years ago that are still open. We've gone into numerous places and not found anything at all after there's been claims of, you name it. There's a demon in my house, and I know this for a fact, and we've seen full-bodied apparitions, and we've seen this, and we've seen that. And we've gone in two or three times into these places and not gotten anything at all.
Right. Well, that's a good thing. And that, no information is just as important as getting information when
Absolutely.
You're doing research like this, and it all needs to be recorded. So, okay,
Absolutely.
I'm glad to hear that because a lot of groups don't do that. They just don't, and that really irks me. I hate
I've had some amazing K2 sessions that I have to believe that something was going
mm-hmm.
on.
Oh, I understand that. I don't get me wrong. I'm a scientist, but I had experiences in the paranormal that I cannot explain. That's what got me interested years ago.
Right.
And I still can't explain them, but I want to try.
Exactly.
And if it's ever going to be, paranormal is ever going to rise from the field of pseudoscience into mainstream science, there's certain protocol that have to be followed, and you have to approach it from the right way. If you don't use a solid scientific methodology and follow it from beginning to end in every investigation, then no one will ever take whatever you find seriously. And
absolutely. And we won't release anything to the public that we haven't exhausted every single effort to try and for lack of a better way of putting it, debunk. Numerous people working on our team that specialize in specific areas. Marcus Cook, who is also here with us right now, is our video specialist. He's an independent filmmaker. He's done many films and motion pictures, and he knows cameras and what they do and what you can easily mistake for paranormal. And we have had things where I've done everything in my power to debunk it and thought that I actually had something, and he was able to look at it time and time again and figure out exactly what it truly was. So I'm never going to release anything to the public that we haven't exhausted every effort of debunking.
Well, like I said, that's commendable and impressive, and kudos to you guys, really. And that ends my questions, so I'll turn it back over to Carolyn. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, you know, I don't normally ask questions, but I have one. Do you guys use the paranormal puck at all?
We don't have one. We don't have one yet, so.
But yeah, they're spendy.
Yeah, some of this stuff gets a little pricey.
Yeah.
So
things like that, I need to personally do more technical research on them. Same with the Ovilus, same with, you know, the Frank's box or the Radio Shack hack or any of those type of ghost boxes. I'm not just going to run right out, being the tech guy for the team, so to speak, I'm not just going to run right out and spend money on something that I haven't thoroughly researched. And a lot of these devices, they just seem iffy to me, you know.
Right.
I truly think that with the sensitive people that we have working on our team as well, we can reproduce the same effects just with someone's abilities. I don't want to say psychic abilities, but
I don't know if you want to say reproduce either.
Well, if you are able to open up your mind and your body and tune in to what is going on in the room, to atmospheric changes, to the way your body is responding, I truly think that all the technology in the world isn't going to stand up to what we can do as human beings if you just train yourself to do so.
Sure, sure. And I like the double approach with the sensitives and the technology. Actually, I have investigated a few times with a local team here, and they do a really good job of sort of combining the best of both worlds. And I think it's a terrific way to investigate.
And we found that you have to. I mean, we can take people that are truly sensitive, that we trust, that we have seen amazing results from, and we'll take the team in without that person, and whatever evidence we get, we will then, you know, file that away for later use, and then bring sensitive people into the same location and see if what they feel and what they experience matches up to what our equipment has been able to do. And when you get there again, when you get the two working in conjunction, just like if you're working with two or three different various pieces of equipment in conjunction and you're getting the same thing, then that's worth researching further.
Sure. Well, do you guys have any final thoughts that you'd like to share with us before we let you go? We've kept you an awfully long time. We appreciate you being willing to talk with us this long.
Steven, you want to go?
I know. I'm listening. But no, I just want to thank you guys for shining a little light on the project. That means so much to all of us. And it was a life-changing experience for everybody that was involved. And And I can't wait for people to really have the, get to check out a lot of the different investigating techniques, experiences that we went through. And I want to thank you guys for really, being into what it is that we're doing. I'm a big fan of the work already, and it's just kind of cool to be able to talk to you guys and really know what you guys want to think about what it is that we're doing, too. We love the feedback and having conversations like this stuff. I know you're kind of tight-lipped about certain things, but all in good time. Yeah, you will see why. But, thank you guys so much for coming on or having us on.
Yeah, thank you so much. Lisa or Ray, any final thoughts?
Yeah, again, as Steven said, thank you, and hopefully people will listen to what we said about the Henrietin Project and not be like, oh, that sucks, they suck too. No. I thank you guys, and for anybody that's going to listen to this, revolutionary thinking is the way that this paranormal community is going to survive. Think outside of the box, constantly try and change the way you do things, and really keep thinking, because if you don't, this is going to become stagnant, boring, and old really quickly. Yeah. Keep using the egg in your brain. Make it work.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good to me. All right, well, thank you, guys. We really appreciate you coming on. And like I say, I appreciate you taking a little extra time. I know we probably promised you 30 minutes, and we've gone well over that. So thanks.
You're quite welcome. Anytime. Thank you.
We had a blast.
Thank you, everybody.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks again, and have a great night.
Thanks, you too.
Okay,
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank
you. If you'd like to be a panelist on Paranormal Underground Presents or have a guest or topic suggestion, please email editor@paranormalunderground.net. Thank you for joining us.
Shoot. Rather than just an investigation.
Okay.
So we knew at 8 o'clock in the morning we're getting up. At 9 o'clock in the morning we're going to be on the road to get there.
To elaborate at that is factual information that we've been able to gain through numbers using the CDC, John Hopkins Medical Library, and as many medical reference tests as we've been able to find. Jenny Stewart and I have kind of randomly talked about maybe we should actually contact the White House or something,
No, it wouldn't be the White House, but there's a branch of the federal government that deals specifically.
Dust masks as we could find.
Okay.
The asbestos that's in all of those buildings is unbelievable. And as I stated earlier, there's no fence around this place. There's no barbed wire around it.
No one will ever take whatever you find seriously. And
absolutely. We won't release anything to the public that we haven't exhausted every single effort to try and for lack of a... We'll take the team in without that person. And whatever evidence we get, we will then, file that away for later use and then bring... sensitive people into this.
Coming on, and like I say, I appreciate you taking a little extra time. I know we probably promised you 30 minutes, and we've gone well over that, so thanks.
You're quite welcome. Anytime. Thank you.
We had a blast.
Thank you, everyone.